Good afternoon. If your laptop is lost or stolen, how safe is the data on it? Well, if it's unlocked and unencrypted, then there's really not much anybody can do to protect your data. Now, if you can screen lock your laptop but still don't use a disk encryption scheme, then this provides a very minimal level of protection because an attacker can just remove your hard drive and transfer it to another computer where you can read the data that way. Now, if you employ the current industry best practice, which involves screen locking your laptop and employing some type of disk encryption scheme, you might have thought your data was safe. But last year, over 119,000 laptops with encrypted hard drives that contained sensitive customer data were lost at the 36 major U.S. airports. That's a pretty big number. Now, your data was probably contained on some of those, account information, social security numbers, stuff like that. So is your data really protected? Well, the research I'm presenting today suggests that maybe not. Now let's review how disk encryption works. Well, disk encryption is commonly implemented as a layer between the file system and the disk drivers. Now this layer transparently, on the fly, encrypts the data as the file system writes and reads blocks from the disk. But accessing the disk requires that a cryptographic key be present in memory. And this is most often derived from the user's password, which the user provides when the laptop boots up. Now, this key must be kept in RAM for as long as the disk is mounted. There's no other place for us to keep the key, and for blocks to be written and read from the disk in encrypted form, the key must be present. Now, the scenario that we're talking about here is when an attacker gains access to a laptop which is running and is screen locked but has a mounted encrypted hard drive. Now, I know what you're thinking. It might not be that common for an attacker to get access to your laptop in this form. But actually, if your laptop's on and it's locked and it's unlocked, there's not much we can do. But if it's off, then it's probably in one of two states. It's probably either hibernating or in a sleep state. Now, think about how often you really turn off your laptop completely. I know I haven't turned my laptop off since I left Princeton on Sunday. So these two scenarios are basically the same for an attacker because you can simply wake them up to bring it into its locked screen, to its screen lock state, which has a mounted encrypted hard disk. So here's the attack scenario. So we've shown that it's actually pretty common for an attacker to be able to gain access to your laptop when it's in this state. So the assumptions we're making here are, first, that the encryption scheme used to protect your data is strong and that the attacker cannot gain access to your laptop, to your data, by accessing the hard drive directly. The second is that the operating system protects the key for as long as the operating system is running and that the attacker is unable to gain access to your key through the operating system. Now, the attacker might try to circumvent the operating system's control by rebooting the machine, but we all know RAM is volatile, so this restart will clear the contents of memory and the key will be lost, right? Well, let's take a look at the way memory works. So main memory is most commonly implemented as dynamic RAM, or DRAM. And DRAM is made up of DRAM cells, which are basically capacitors. And we could think of these capacitors as leaky storage tanks for electrons. So let's say we want to write the bit value 1 to this DRAM cell. When we do this, charge builds up on the capacitor, and when the capacitor is fully charged, this signifies the bit value 1. So as time passes, our cell begins to lose, our leaky storage tank loses electrons, and eventually we get to the point where we have to refresh the contents. This is a read-rewrite combination that's commonly performed at fixed intervals, approximately every 32 milliseconds. And this is why it's called dynamic RAM. It's dynamic in the sense that the contents need to be refreshed in order to maintain the state. So this refresh causes charge to build up again and the value to be restored. Now, what happens if we don't refresh, as commonly happens when you lose power to the computer? Well, our DRAM cell returns to its ground state, and we've lost the bit of information that we once stored there. So the assumption here is that when the laptop loses power, the refresh cycle doesn't occur, and that any data that was present in your DRAM cell decays very quickly, and that it decays much too quickly for us to be able to recover any information. Now, the truth isn't quite that simple. So to illustrate this, we took this image and created a bitmap out of it, and we wrote this pattern of bits into memory, and we cut the power to the machine and measured decay after periods of time. Now, after 5 seconds, most of the original data is still visible. In fact, only a few bits differ. Now, as time passes, the decay occurs quite gradually, and after 5 minutes, some of the original data is still visible. If you look closely, you can see the outline of the Mona Lisa. Now, these black and white bars that you're seeing are actually due to the physical wiring of RAM chips, where a 1 sometimes signifies the bit value 1, whereas sometimes a 0 signifies the bit value 1. So I encourage you to take a look at our paper for more information on this phenomenon. But this general phenomenon is something that's called DRAM remnants, which has been known to semiconductor engineers for some time, but it came as a surprise to most of us in the security community. Now, there have been rumblings of this and mentions in passing in some various papers, but nobody's really characterized this in the way that we have. So this forces us to discard the assumption that the contents of RAM decay almost instantaneously when we cut the power and the refresh cycle doesn't occur. And our experiments show that the decay is actually quite gradual, on the order of seconds, and that the decay occurs unidirectionally, with a particular DRAM cell almost always decaying towards zero or towards one. Now, we also saw that the decay is quite predictable, with a particular DRAM cell almost... So an attacker can run experiments on the memory chip to determine the order and rate of decay for a particular DRAM cell. Now, the decay isn't always the same for every memory technology. Newer memory technologies that have much higher density circuitry decay much more quickly than older memory technologies, which usually employ much lower density circuitry. So you might think that it might be difficult to read the previous contents of memory, but that turns out not to be the case. And we can do this quite easily using nothing more than a simple USB stick and a little bit of code. Now, an attacker can't boot a full-featured operating system in order to extract the contents of RAM. Now, that's because full-featured operating systems have a very large memory footprint, and the attacker risks overwriting large portions of memory which might possibly contain the cryptographic key that he's interested in. So the solution to this is to write a small, low-level program whose only purpose is to write out or dump the contents of memory to a storage device. Now, we created a few test implementations, two network-based attacks, EFI dump and Pixie dump, and a USB-based attack called USB dump. Now, the smallest of these implementations is only 9 kilobytes in size. And we actually also implemented an iPod-based attack so that the attacker can do this without addressing and causing any undue attention. So using this process, an attacker can launch what we call a cold boot attack. Now, in its most basic form, an attacker gains access to your laptop when it's screen locked and running. If it was hibernating or sleeping, he can just wake it up. Now, the first step is for the attacker to insert this USB disk and to quickly power cycle the machine. Now, the machine automatically boots off of the USB disk, which automatically reads the previous contents of RAM and stores them on the USB disk. Now, because the encrypted drive was mounted before the attacker rebooted the machine, the cryptographic key must be contained in memory. So the attacker can search through this memory image to find the key and use the key to decrypt the hard drive. But things aren't always quite this simple. I mean, what if the BIOS is automatically set to clear the contents of RAM on boot? Well, it's actually quite common in machines that support extended memory tests and machines that support ECC RAM. So when the machine is rebooted, the BIOS automatically clears the contents of RAM. So you might think the attacker is dead in the water, but it's actually not so. The attacker can employ what we call the advanced cold boot attack, where the attacker has his own computer, which has been set not to clear the contents of RAM on boot. The attacker can then remove the RAM from the victim's computer and physically transfer it to the attacker's computer, where he can then read the contents of RAM locally without any of the restrictions that the BIOS or the operating system might have imposed. So now transferring the RAM takes time, and you might think the attacker might not be able to do this too quickly, and that some of the contents of RAM might decay to a state that the attacker can't recover any information. And this might be true at room temperature, but cooling the chips dramatically slows the decay. And we tested a very simple cooling technique using the so-called canned air containers, which, when inverted, cool the chips to negative 50 degrees Celsius. Now, we tested this, and after an entire minute without power, we saw only 0.2% of the bits had flipped. So here's a close-up. So between tests, we cleaned up the condensation as best as we could, and the RAM and the computer survived dozens of tests. So if we keep the RAM cool, we can remove it from the computer for minutes without significant decay. And this is a cheap, safe, practical way of transferring the RAM from one computer to another without losing very much data. Now, to test the limits of this approach, we experimented with some liquid nitrogen. Now, this will cool the chips to 196 degrees Celsius below zero. And we saw only 0.17% of the bits had decayed after an entire hour without power. So that at this rate, the data could remain intact for days. Now, instead of cooling the chips, another way for the attacker to deal with bit errors, which would probably occur, especially if the attacker didn't use cooling, would be to use some type of key recovery algorithm. So we developed a few of these. The first naive approach assumes the attacker has some decayed version of the key, K prime, and he's trying to recover the true version of the key, K. Now, he could do a brute force search over the Hamming distance of keys that are very close to K prime, but this search could quickly become infeasible. For example, with a 256-bit key that has about 10% error, the attacker would have to guess more than 2 to the 56 times in order to stumble upon the true key. But we had an insight. Most of the programs that we're interested in contain not just the key itself, but pre-computed derivatives of the key, or expanded versions of the key, which in block ciphers are commonly called key schedules. Now, these derivatives have a lot of structure and a lot of redundancy, and we can treat them as error-correcting codes. So, for example, correcting bit errors in a DES key. Now, the DES key schedule is actually quite simple, and the thing you need to know about this is that the key schedule contains about 14 redundant copies of each and every bit of the key. So let's say the attacker wants to know what the true value of bit 4 was. So he lists all 14 redundant copies of bit 4, and he can take a simple majority vote to determine what the true value would be. Now, in this case, the true answer is 4. So you can repeat this for all of the bits of the key. Now, let's take a look at how AES encryption works. Well, 128-bit AES encryption is performed in a series of 11 rounds, with each round using a different round key. And each round key is derived from the round key used before, with round key 0 being the master key, or the true key K. Now, these round keys together are called the key schedule, and are approximately 176 bytes of key material that's available to the attacker. So, we developed a technique for recovering the keys given the key schedule as a type of error correcting code. Now, round key 1 has these 4 bytes, which uniquely determine the corresponding 3 bytes in round key one. And we call this group of 7 bytes a slice. And even though there are 56 bits, there are really only 2 to the 32 possibilities, and we can simply enumerate all of these for each 7-byte slice. And this allows us to eliminate values that are unlikely to have occurred given the decayed values that we observed. So for each slice, each 4 bytes, we simply enumerate the 2 to the 32 options and eliminate those values that are very unlikely to have occurred. And this eliminates the vast majority of them. Now, there's a high amount of linearity in the way that the way these slices are related. So we can separate this, and we can repeat this process for each of these 4 slices. So when we do this, we can combine the possible slice values to form candidate keys, and we combine them in the order that produces the highest likelihood that the observed values decayed, that the a true candidate key decayed to what we observed. So we test candidate keys by calculating the entire extended version of the key schedule and comparing it to what we saw in memory. Now, if the total Hamming distance between the extended key schedule and the observed bytes is low enough, then this gives us a pretty good measure of certainty that this is the true candidate. This is the true key that was originally written to memory. So this works not just with AES key schedules, but with other types of pre-computed derivatives. So AES and DES have pre-computed redundant data, which are called key schedules, and LRW tweet keys have multiplication tables, RSA private keys have the primes P and Q, as well as a few other derivative values. Now, this leads to an interesting relationship between the efficiency versus security trade-off. Now, it's very efficient for disk encryption schemes to have this type of pre-computed data lying around in memory, but it introduces a very important security trade-off that must be made, because having this much redundant information allows the attacker to recover the key even under significant amounts of error. But how does the attacker find the key? Well, previous methods have focused on 2 broad categories. The first is looking for by keys based on entropy. So they look for regions of memory that satisfy so the bits are independent in the part of memory that they're looking for. But most of the high entropy data in memory isn't key material. It's compressed data, like MP3s, pictures, like JPEGs, and other such things. Now, they can also look for stuff based on a data structure. That requires knowing the internal details of a particular software package, and that might require some reverse engineering. But our method focuses not on the keys themselves, but on the entire key schedule, and it's precise and fully automatic. And this even works with moderate amounts of decay. And it doesn't require us to analyze any particular target program. So let me explain. So for our memory, for each byte in our memory dump, we iterate through them, and we treat each following region as a possible AES key schedule. Now for each word in the schedule, we calculate the correct value and assume that the other bytes around it are correct. And then we take the Hamming distance from our calculated value to our observed value, and we repeat this for all of the bytes in the candidate schedule. And if the total distance is low, then this is very likely to have been a true AES key schedule, and we output the key. So here are the steps of the cold boot attack. We've shown how the attacker can extract the previous contents of memory using a small, low-level program, how he can locate the keys in memory by using the key schedule as a type of identifier, how he can reconstruct the keys by using the pre-computed redundant data as an error-correcting code, and how he can use the key to decrypt the hard drive. So we've implemented a few proof-of-concept attacks on some of the more popular disk encryption schemes. The first was Microsoft Vista's BitLocker, which is built into Microsoft Windows Vista. The second was macOS 10's FileVault, which is built into macOS 10 Leopard, and three open-source disk encryption schemes, Linux's DMCrypt, LoopAES, and TrueCrypt. Now, as further proof of the effectiveness of the cold boot attack, we created a fully automated attack against Microsoft Vista's BitLocker, which we call BitUnlocker. Now, in our method, the attacker simply has to insert a USB drive, which contains our code, and quickly power cycle the machine. Our code then automatically dumps the previous contents of memory, runs keyfind to find the encryption keys used to encrypt the hard drive, and then we can automatically decrypt the contents. We can automatically recover the keys using the pre-computed derivatives as a key schedule. Then the disk is automatically mounted, allowing the attacker to interactively browse the data. Now, we can do this without any cooling. So all you have to do is connect the drive, reboot, and you can browse. Now, we talked about a lot of ways to exploit this phenomenon of DRAM remnants. But what about some possible countermeasures? Well, there are no perfect solutions. There is no magic bullet. And all of the commercially available countermeasures have some sort of drawback. So I'll talk about a few of the more promising ones. So the first one is just encrypting the contents of memory during sleep. Now, the way this works is we encrypt the pages of memory which contain cryptographic key material using the user's password, and then we unmount the disk. Now, when the laptop is reawakened, the pages of memory that contain the cryptographic material are automatically decrypted when the user is prompted for their password. Now, the good thing is that this is a good short-term solution, but it requires an operating system change in the case of BitLocker, Vista, and macOS 10. Now, the downside to this is that it requires that the user not have background processes that want to access the disk. The reason is that the cryptographic keys are already encrypted with the user's password, and they're not available to the disk encryption scheme. So we could try this approach. But another thing we could do is just have the disk encryption scheme not pre-compute this data. Now, this makes recovery more difficult, but it doesn't make it impossible. And it might really hurt performance, because the disk encryption scheme would have to recalculate the key schedule every time they wanted to read and write blocks of data from the disk. But an attacker could just cool the chips, which would reduce the error, and that would mean that alternate key recovery schemes might not even need to use this pre-computed redundant data to find the keys and decrypt the hard drive. Now, another solution is to try something that's fully contained in hardware, something like encrypted memory. So when this requires a hardware change. So when the device boots up, a cryptographic key is randomly chosen, and this key is used to encrypt the contents of memory for as long as power is maintained. Now, when data is read or written from the cache, it's automatically encrypted and decrypted before it's stored in main memory. Now, if an attacker tries to reboot the machine to circumvent operating system control, this would cause a CPU reset to occur, which would clear the key and cause a new key to be randomly generated. Now, this also protects against the attack scenario where the attacker physically removes the RAM chip from the victim's computer and transfers it to the attacker's computer, because the contents of RAM are encrypted with a key that the attacker does not have access to. But we already have something that's used to store cryptographic keys, right? It's called the TPM. Now, TPMs, as are most commonly implemented today, are mainly used to authenticate the hardware. And current TPMs may actually be used to help the attacker, as is evidenced by Microsoft Vista's BitLocker when it's in its basic mode. Now, the way trusted platform modules work in BitLocker's basic mode is that when the laptop boots up, the operating system prompts the TPM and asks for the key. The TPM then authenticates Vista and hands off the key, which is used to mount the disk, and the cryptographic key is stored in memory for as long as the disk is mounted. Now, this is done without any password provided from the user. This allows the laptop to be vulnerable to a cold boot attack, even if it's been off for weeks. So, in this way, TPMs might not provide the level of protection that we might have thought in this scenario. Now, trusted platform modules in the future I hear, are being developed with new features, namely bulk encryption features, and this can really protect against this type of attack. So what are the main contributions to this? Well, we've characterized this phenomenon of DRAM amendments in a significant way, and we described a new type of attack called the cold boot attack, which allows the attacker to recover encryption keys that were stored in memory. We've described methods for automatically finding the keys using the key schedule as an identifier, and we described ways to recover the keys by using the key schedule's error correcting code. And we've also described some attacks on popular disk encryption schemes. And we've discussed some remedies and their limitations. So I want you to take away four main things from this talk. The first is that DRAM decays on the order of seconds without refresh, not milliseconds. And this is slow enough to allow some significant data recovery if the attacker is given physical access. And the main thing that I want you to take away is that software has no safe place to store cryptographic key material. RAM is just not safe enough. And that any mitigation that we try to launch requires some compromises, either in new hardware, significant cost, or in changed user behavior. So for more information, some videos, and some source code, please visit our website at citp.princeton.edu/memory. Thanks.
Thanks. Any questions or comments?
Do you know if anybody's been working on, for Linux, an encrypt on sleep solution to deal with this?
I'm not personally aware of that, but I think that that's something that's definitely within the scope of the open source community. Yeah. So I would support that wholeheartedly.
And do you know if there's any laptops that still provide power to the DRAM when it's shut down, but the power supply is plugged in, so the battery's charging and such?
So the situation is when the laptop is in sleep mode, or completely
off.
No,
it's actually shut down.
Shut down.
Yeah.
And the power adapter is plugged in, so that maintains the refresh cycle. I'm not personally aware of that, but I don't know what would be the benefit of them.
Probably
doing
none.
That.
I just didn't know if anybody had kind of implemented that without thinking through the sort of consequence.
Yeah, that would seem like it would be something additional that wouldn't add any new features to a user because they could just hibernate it.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about it more as an accidental kind of design.
Yeah, no, we didn't notice that.
Okay, great.
In both of your attacks, do you know what is actually providing the power to the DRAM cells to keep them going? So in the case of where they're left in the laptop, is the laptop accidentally providing it some power? And in the case of where you remove it, is it the DRAM chips themselves, or is it other power management capacitors on the DIMM?
Okay. So I think what you're asking is, the way we performed our experiments without power was we used laptops and we had them only plugged in using a power adapter and we physically removed the battery. So in our test, we pulled the plug so there was no power source to the device. Now, the second part of your question relates to where the refresh cycle is actually occurring. And my understanding is that it's occurring on the DRAM chip itself. So it has its own refresh controller. So whenever power is provided to it, it automatically performs the refresh cycle.
It wasn't the refresh cycle, but... Well, when you pull out power from an SRAM cell, a DRAM cell, the data will decay.
Yes.
But obviously not fast enough. Also on the DIMM, there are capacitors, and it could be that the capacitor is giving it enough power to cause it not to decay as fast.
That's definitely possible. So, you'd have to look at particular implementations to see where this residual power was coming from that was causing the decay to be much more slow than we might typically assume. So, but I'm not aware of those particular details.
Hey, you said something about the newer DRAMs take more time to the memory there decreases in a faster rate. So, could you elaborate more about the kinds of DRAMs and how long does it take for each one of them to lose the memory?
Yeah, so newer RAM technologies like DDR2 typically employ much higher density circuitry. So they're typically characterized like 512 megabit, which is kind of a useless measurement. But it has to do with how many DRAM cells are in a particular region area. So older memory technologies were only produced with like 128 megabit densities. So they decay much more slowly. And I think that has to do with the physical size of the DRAM chips or of the DRAM cells, as well as the voltage range that's used. So in newer memory technologies, there's a much smaller voltage range, so the capacitor decays much more quickly.
And your work addressed which kind of...
In the paper we discuss the trends we saw in particular memory technologies. So we can go over that offline if you want. It's in the paper.
Thanks.
Niels Provost, Google. I'm wondering if you're aware of the work done by Mark Connor and Brian Noble on transient authentication, where basically they have a wristwatch, and if they walk away from the laptop, memory gets encrypted, and without the wristwatch, you cannot decrypt it. It seems that is a good example of a system that actually does not suffer from these problems here.
Yeah, that seems like a good solution. I'm not particularly aware of that. Maybe you could provide me with that, the details on that. But I think that anything that adds a physical change to the device is something that's that would have increased cost. And that so is this an add-on to the laptop itself, where it's a connect like a USB connection to the laptop, and then that coordinates?
I think there's some kind of Bluetooth or wireless communication, and then they made operating system kernel changes to just encrypt the operating system memory when the laptop got suspended or when they walked away from the laptop.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about that offline. But I think that's definitely a reasonable countermeasure.
And then I have a follow-up question. So for some crypto systems, key schedule computation is actually so quick that there is no real need for keeping it in memory. And AES is one of the examples.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it seems that might be another way of making some of your attacks more.
Less. I see what you're saying. But the problem is that if the key schedule is in memory at any particular time, so if the file system is trying to access the disk, then the key schedule has to be present in memory, even if it's only there for an instant. If an attacker can cause the key schedule to be generated, then he can power cycle the machine and read the contents of memory, which would then find the key schedule there.
Sure.
So the encryption scheme doesn't have to keep the key schedule there for a prolonged period of time, but if the attacker can find the key schedule there at any moment in time, then he can use it as an error correcting code.
Okay, thanks. Great.
No problem.
Great. Thanks, Will.